Hello and welcome to the Real Estate Matters podcast. I'm Stuart Norton with the Alabama Center for Real Estate at the University of Alabama. And today we have a returning guest, Alicia Cassidy, Assistant Professor of Economics here at UA. How you doing, Alicia?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So how's your semester going?
It's going great.
Good to hear. So you have a relatively new paper out, but if you'll just share the title of that paper real quick, and then we'll get into a good discussion.
Yeah, so my paper is called Cleaning Up the Great Lakes, Housing Market Impacts of Removing Legacy Pollutants.
Okay.
It's joint with Robin Meeks and Michael Moore.
Michael Moore, would that be of documentary fame?
No.
I had a feeling it wasn't, but I think he did something recently about water quality in that area.
It's an ironic coincidence, right?
Yeah. So speaking of the Great Lakes region, I guess we can kind of start with, pollution in that area, because everyone's, heard about, the water issues in Flint, Michigan, and it sounds like it's not just limited to that area. So what's it like, or how badly polluted has that area been over the years?
It's been changing over the years. It's been the case that water quality in the Great Lakes has been trending upwards over time.
Right.
The history of manufacturing in that region left behind a lot of pollutants, legacy pollutants, pollutants that have taken decades to remediate.
Right.
It's still a problem. The area is still being monitored for these legacy pollutants. And our federal government has spent almost $1.23 billion on this issue, because the Great Lakes are a huge source of fresh water for the United States.
Yeah, and kind of talking about the Great Lakes for a minute here, that's one body of water I've never seen. I gotta get myself up there at some point. But I hear they're just amazing. I mean, obviously, you see how big they are on a map, but it seems like you really have to get out there on a boat, and you can literally lose sight of shore from what I've heard.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. And, so you go out there far enough, it basically feels like you're in the ocean. The Great Lakes, largest freshwater system in the world, pretty much, isn't it? The Great Lakes and its tributaries.
Yeah.
And that's, and when you think about like the history and development of the United States, I mean, it's really, because I believe the Mississippi River, originates up there near the Great Lakes, somewhere in Minnesota. But just thinking about, the Mississippi River and just, obviously the impact that had on the development of America, basically this, long navigable waterway, no waterfalls or anything, they could go up and down that on a barge or boat, basically since, early pioneer history, but just a really cool part of the country. I got to see it someday.
Yes, you certainly do.
Yeah. And you spent a little time up there, didn't you?
I spent time in Ann Arbor, Michigan.
Okay.
We did see multiple parts of the Great Lakes, not all the lakes. It's definitely a place you want to go. You should put it on your bucket list.
Yeah. I hear the summers are beautiful. And the beaches. Who would have thought you'd have beaches on the Great Lakes? But supposedly that's a pretty common thing as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so back to the paper, basically. And when you talk about legacy, before we get back to the paper, but like legacy pollutants, like versus, just like ordinary pollution, is there any difference between those two?
I think when we say legacy pollutants, we mean persistent chemicals like PCBs and PBDEs. So PCBs are polychlorinated biphenyls. I don't really know how to pronounce that word.
Totally.
So those were like commonly used as coolants and insulating fluids.
Right.
PBDEs are polybrominated diphenyl ethers, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right. So those were used as flame retardants.
Okay.
So those are the types of chemicals that we think of when we say legacy pollutants.
Right.
But I'm not sure if I have a concrete definition of what separates a legacy pollutant from a non-legacy pollutant.
Well, hey,
and the region really suffers from both types of pollutants.
Right. Yeah. And so the main point is there's been, you know, obviously, you know, with that being in the Rust Belt, you know, heavy manufacturing, you know, you think Detroit, you know, all around the Great Lakes, Chicago, I mean, just, you know, lots of manufacturing taking place in that era. And so basically they're left over from, you know, pollution that could have occurred, you know, decades ago. You know, it's been cleaned up a good bit, it sounds like, but there's still some work to be done.
For sure.
Yeah. And so what were your big findings in the paper regarding water quality and house prices?
So our first finding was that there is this sort of stigma effect associated with being near a polluted body of water.
Right.
And having your area labeled as contaminated with hazardous pollutants. So we see that housing prices fall in response to the AOC listing, which was the designation of these areas as having hazardous water quality. But then we see the second finding is that the grants that were given by the federal government and also matched by local funds to clean up these areas of concern, they're called, those grants were able to overcome the negative impacts of that listing, that designation on housing prices.
Right. So basically, yeah. So once efforts were made to, you know, to improve water quality in the area, then I guess you could see that result, you know, in the home prices, it sounds like.
Yes. So people are willing to pay a premium to not live near polluted water. And that premium also changes back when you've cleaned up the area.
Right. Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That's something we really take for granted. You know, it's kind of hard to imagine, you know, turning on the tap, you know, and you have water that, you know, might not be safe to drink, might not be safe to cook with, you know, might have a little smell, you know, smell or color. I mean, it's just something we take for granted, you know, that the water quality is going to be quite decent. But yeah, I could definitely see how, you know, poor water quality in an area, it's definitely, I mean, it's going to push down home prices, but it's a big deterrent, you know, to relocate to that area, or just a major problem to overcome for people living there.
For sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And so what were some of the, did you look at any, what were some of the specific cities that you looked at in the region?
Yeah, so we focused on these areas of concern, which were these places that were tagged as having hazardous water quality. And those aren't only in cities. They're also in rural areas. And you can imagine that people might travel to these areas to access the Great Lakes for recreation or fishing or other purposes.
Yeah, that makes sense. And with those pollutants, because I know that, like, it's kind of, it's common, you know, that once those, you know, they leach into the groundwater, and I think that's really where the problems kind of begin, you know, or not begin, but that's, you know, just another layer of problems there. But yeah, but once you have those pollutants in the groundwater, you know, it eventually gets into the water supply and has a pretty, you know, yeah, pretty solid effect on the people living there, I would imagine.
Yes.
Yeah. And so more about the Rust Belt in general, I'm just trying to, you know, imagine, you know, you hear the Rust Belt, exactly, you know, not really a positive sounding term, if you know what I mean, you know, it ties into, you know, decay and everything. But do you think, I mean, has there been now, you know, it sounds like water quality is trending up in most areas. But does it look like, you know, is manufacturing going to ever get back to the point where it was in that area? You know, just,
you know, that's not
reaction.
That's not my area of expertise.
Gotcha. Well, let's stick with house prices.
Yeah, let's stick with house prices. So I think a good area to get into next would be to sort of disentangle what people are valuing.
Okay.
In this study, so we see that people value cleaner water, but why? There could be multiple reasons. It could be for fishing purposes. It could be related to their expectations about drinking water. It could be that they like going to the beach. It could be purely for, you know, sightseeing. So there's lots of different mechanisms here. And what I really would like to study is those separate mechanisms. How does each one of them contribute to that price premium that we put on clean water?
Yeah, that's a good point, because it's it goes well beyond, you know, just drinking water. It does, and like the recreational value. I mean, like one reason, you know, people go to the beach, you know, or go out on the boat is to kind of to be in nature. And when you're in nature, you know, you don't want that, you know, the sights or the sounds of pollution, you know, to be there on the beach, you know, or to be out in the Great Lakes. But speaking of recreational value, I mean, like when your time spent up there, did y'all ever hit the water on the Great Lakes? Is that something you or any friends of would do?
We went up to Northern Michigan, and we went to the beach. We went out on, you know, a boat near Niagara Falls. It's a sight to behold.
Yeah, I can imagine. And one of your colleagues, Eric Johnson, also an econ professor here at UA, talking to him this morning, got a little jealous, but he has a cabin at the, his family has a cabin up on the, totally off the grid, he said, up on the UP, mm-hmm. like no running water, you know, I think they have a generator for power, wow. Maybe they have a well, but basically, you know, just kind of got my attention, you know, because it's just really off the beaten path way up there. And they mostly fish and, you know, do outdoorsy type stuff. But when he told me that this morning, I was like, wow, Eric, that's that sounds like a fun week.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So back to, you know, so when we're talking home values, you know, obviously water plays a good value, or, you know, water quality when you're determining home values. But what would you say are some of the other factors that tie into home values? Obviously, it's kind of, you know, we could go on and on at this for days, but we know water quality is one. What are some others?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many. You know, so interest rates are very important to home values. We've got various market hotness indicators that play into home values, like the inventory and
inventory, that's one thing. It's been, there's just not much for sale, you know, and that's true here in Alabama. You know, you driving around town, you know, you don't see as many signs in the yard as you used to, but it's a national thing as well, and I'm sure it's affecting, that's one thing that's propping up home prices at the moment, is there's just not that much out there for sale. And so
that's even, right.
Yeah, and so even though we've seen interest rates tick up a good bit, you know, home values are basically holding steady, which is good news for your average homeowner. And then Dr. Tidwell did an interesting study about curb appeal, you know, the impact of curb appeal on home prices, which is what I find, you know, a lot of the factors are obviously intangible. It's kind of difficult to study. But did you get a chance to see or, you know, to hear a little bit about that paper that Dr. Tidwell did a few years back?
I did. It's super interesting.
Yeah. The way that they quantified curb appeal, I can't recall it, you know, exactly at the moment. But I thought that was pretty cool how they quantified something that is historically kind of difficult to quantify. I'm sure that's a problem you kind of you encounter in economics quite a bit, isn't it?
It certainly is. I mean, my last podcast was about my paper on energy efficiency in housing, and it was very difficult to quantify the energy efficiency, the overall energy efficiency of a house.
Right. Yeah. There's so many different things you can look at. So you also did another paper on housing prices, but I'd just be interested to hear, and I think our audience would be as well, how you go about gathering data for a project like that. So how does that work?
Sure. So it depends on whether you're studying individual transactions or kind of transactions at a more aggregated level. In our paper on cleaning up the Great Lakes, we have individual transactions data from CoreLogic. And that includes a variety of mortgage-related variables, as well as housing prices for each individual transaction. So it's a detailed, and it's usually at the parcel level. It's a very detailed data set. And for this paper on cleaning up the Great Lakes, we matched that with geospatial data on these areas themselves.
Right.
So we had shapefiles of the areas of concern, and we were able to pinpoint how far away a house is from an area of concern.
Oh, okay.
Is it within the area of concern? Is it, 5 kilometers away, et cetera? In a new project with Lala Ma and Elaine Hill, we're looking at the impact of cleaning up RCRA sites. So RCRA is the Resource Conservation and Recovery Act. That's a program that cleans up, for example, pollution from a particular factory. Would be an example of something that's targeted to clean up. In that paper, we actually use publicly available census data. I really like using publicly available census data because I think that it makes for replicable research.
Okay. And you can trust it too, you would think.
Yeah, for yeah. sure. For yeah. sure. So I think that's the advantage there. But it is cool to have individual transactions, to be honest with you.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So you can kind of, you can look at it generally, but then also look at it more specifically. I guess to kind of, you'd have your idea in general, but then I guess it would corroborate, your findings in a way. So,
yes.
And so generally speaking, how long, a very general question, but generally speaking, how long will the research process take?
Oh my gosh. way too long. So right. I think I started this paper on cleaning up the Great Lakes. I think we started it in, 2017.
Oh wow.
Yeah, maybe even 2016. I'd have to ask my co-authors. Don't quote me on that, but it takes a really long time, like at least 5 years. It's crazy.
Wow.
The amount of checks you have to do. What'd you say?
I had a feeling it was going to be longer than I would think, longer than most people would think. So
that's right.
Yeah. So yeah, almost 5 years. Wow. When you're publishing, I've always found it interesting too, because what journal was the paper about water quality in?
The Journal of Public Economics.
Okay, and so how does the publishing process work? Because that's probably a long timeline as well, I would imagine. Just finding someone to publish it, going through that process. Could you just tell us a little bit more about how that works?
Yeah, so I feel like you submit a paper and then you get a lot of negative feedback and then, wash, rinse, and repeat.
Right.
You try your best to address that negative feedback, submit it to another journal. It just keeps going.
Right.
And that's part of the reason why it takes so long. But I think that in the end, the refereeing process, especially once you've been offered a revise and resubmitted a journal, those comments from referees are golden, and they really improve your paper. No matter how polished you think it is, doing those additional checks adds a new layer of rigor.
Right, and it sounds like that's I've heard about the peer review process, but it sounds like that would be pretty much what you're going through there.
So we've already, so this paper is already done. It's right. set to come out in October. And we don't have to do any more revisions, but of course on other papers, I'm still in that process.
Right. Yeah. And I guess, at the end of the day, you want a fine-tuned product. And so that's where all the feedback kind of comes in.
Yes.
And And I guess it's also a good sign too, because if they're giving you that many notes and comments, it's something they're interested in. It's something they want to improve. So I guess that's better than just getting no feedback, which probably means it's not going to not make it in the journal.
Exactly. Yeah, that means they're bored.
Right. So the long timeline, the research process. But going back to the census data, what exactly, when y'all were going through the census data, what were some of the points y'all were pulling there?
Yeah, so we were looking at housing values and how they changed with the RCRA cleanups, as well as a lot of demographic data on race, income, age, number of children, etc.
Right. And what are, also had a note just to talk about the demographics of the area. Is that something you'd want to talk about a little bit?
The demographics of
like, just the Great Lakes region or your area of study.
So we don't directly have results on demographics. Mm-hmm. Instead, we use them as, you know, control variables in some ancillary checks.
Gotcha.
The point is more to ensure that those changes in those demographics are not causing confounding in our results.
Gotcha. Okay. So that's kind of just like another layer of analysis to make sure you're coming to, you know, a good conclusion. It sounds mm-hmm. like.
That's right.
Well, cool. Well, it makes me think, you know, because pretty much, you know, any city you go, well, the Black Warrior River, I don't know if you go out on the Black Warrior much, but I've got this little fishing boat that I keep in the garage. And I remember the first time I took it out on the Black Warrior, I was, you know, middle of summer, and I was like, you know what, I can't wait to get in and take a swim. And right as soon as I launched the boat, I was like, yeah, I don't think I'm going to do that. And so, you know, but obviously being the lowest point in town, and we do have a good bit of industry along the Black Warrior. But I imagine that, you know, the same would hold true for the Mississippi River, the Ohio River, you know, pretty much most of your major rivers, you know, along the eastern side of the country. You know, you're going to have some questionable water quality, you know, whether it affects the surrounding, you know, fortunately, we're lucky here, you know, the water supply is Lake Tuscaloosa, which is a lot cleaner, you know, than the river itself. But I would imagine that this is probably, that most of the other major waterways, especially in the eastern part of the country where you have just more people living, you know, you get out into the mountains, you know, that's where you can get some clean water. But I would imagine that, you know, most of the major waterways in the eastern part of the country are a little bit more polluted than, you know, than would be ideal.
Yeah, it's unfortunate.
Yeah, it really is. But, you know, I'm sure if you traveled around the world, I've never been to Egypt. That's also on my list of places to go. I want to see the pyramids one day. But I've heard the Nile River is just like, you know, you wouldn't even put your big toe down in there.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Yeah, just because you have, if you look at a map of Egypt, it's just because of the desert, pretty much everyone lives within about a mile of the river. Most of the large, you know, of course, you have some people that, you know, live in other areas, but the population's all closely settled around the Nile. And of course, that leads to pollution. But yeah, even if our waterways are, you know, somewhat polluted here in the U.S., I'm sure it could be a lot worse. And it's probably gotten a lot better through the years.
So. Yeah. It's getting better. There's lots of research to show that, but it's still, you know, it's still very unfortunate how many areas in the United States alone are so polluted from the remnants of manufacturing long ago.
Right. And do you think, I know it's not your area of expertise, but I would think that today's manufacturers, you know, they probably learned a little bit from the mistakes of the past, but do you think we're polluting at the same levels today that we were, say, 50 years ago?
It doesn't seem so. It seems like regulation has helped a ton. Regulation has spurred investment in new technologies that are not, that don't pollute as much.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, that's, I remember studying in a political science class, there was, I think it was the Clean Air Act back in the 70s, but that was a bit like, basically like air pollution today is so much better than it was, like smog, all that, But, you know, we're breathing cleaner air than Americans were back in the 60s and 70s. And so that's something to feel good about.
For sure.
Awesome. Well, hey, Alicia, any final thoughts here as we wrap it up?
No, just thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. Always fun. Really liked your topic there. I thought that was a very interesting way to approach housing values. Honestly, that's never crossed my mind, you know, because I just kind of take clean water for granted. But that's a pretty cool approach and a really interesting topic. And congratulations on having that published pretty soon in October next month.
That's right. Thank you so much, Stuart.
Yeah,
I really
enjoyed
participating in this podcast.
Well, hey, we appreciate it as always, and thank you all for listening.
This has been the Real Estate Matters podcast produced by the Alabama Center for Real Estate. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, TuneIn, Spotify, Podbean, or just ask Alexa to play the Real Estate Matters podcast.